It's on the top stories. Iran says its talks with the remaining signatories of the 2015 nuclear deal will bear fruit if the U.S. abandons Donald Trump's failed legacy. UK Health Secretary Matt Hancock resigns following revelations he broke government's coronavirus restrictions. The death toll from the collapse of a building in Florida rises to 5 as rescue workers keep searching for more than 150 people still missing. Welcome to the program. Iran says it has been the most active party in talks aimed at the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal, but it warns that it will not negotiate forever. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman says it is possible for the talks to lead to a deal if Washington abandons, quote, former President Trump's failed legacy. Saeed Khatibzadeh noted that Iran has proposed the largest number of drafts at the talks. Iran and the remaining signatories to the deal have so far held several rounds of talks in the Austrian capital in an attempt to revive the accord known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The aim is to make practical arrangements required for the U.S. to return to the deal it withdrew from in 2018. Washington has so far opposed Tehran's demand that all anti-Iran sanctions be removed first. Political commentator Mr. Kevin Barrett says the U.S. has grossly violated its obligations under the Iran nuclear deal and it should take the first step and remove all sanctions.
Biden would have to clearly break with Trump's legacy and even break with Obama's sort of strategic ambiguity about some of the sanctions, trying to retain some of the sanctions and claiming that they're not nuclear related. He needs to just end the sanctions on Iran. If he's willing to do that, the deal can continue, and if he's not, it won't. It's really that simple. So the ball is now in the Americans' court, and Iran is doing everything that it ever could possibly be asked to do to try to keep the deal going. Iran's patience has really been tested because, you know, first, the Obama administration signed this solemn treaty. It has the force of a treaty under international law, and then Trump came in and just tore it up. How would the Americans feel if the deal had been torn up by a new Iranian administration and then Iran just totally left the deal and started building nuclear weapons, let's say? Not, I don't think Iran actually wants to do that, but if it had, the Americans would have been upset. They would have said that that's not responsible behavior. You signed this deal, you stick with the deal, and we're going to penalize you. Now, the U.S., as it turns out, is the one that has grossly abrogated the deal and now is making noises about coming back into it. Well, come back into it then. Drop the sanctions. This isn't really that complicated.
Thousands of Afghan families have been forced to flee their homes in Kunduz amid the Taliban's extended offensive to seize control of the northern city. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed that matter with our guests. Take a look, please.
Over 5,000 Afghan families have now fled their homes in the northern city of Kunduz as the Taliban forces continue to surround the key city. Officials say another 8,000 families have been displaced throughout the province, this after a month of sporadic clashes between the insurgents and government forces. A new wave of fighting has erupted in the province of Kunduz over a week now, leaving 30 civilians dead and 225 wounded. The violence comes ahead of a planned withdrawal of U.S. troops from the country by this September the 11th. The Taliban says that they have seized nearly 90 of the country's more than 400 districts. But much of the claim has been disputed by the central government. Peace talks between the two warring sides in Qatar have also been stuck at a deadlock. And now joining us for the program is Robert Fantina, author and journalist, joining us from Kitchener, Ontario, and Mr. Nicholas Ayala, editor at Anticonquista, joining us out of New York, New Jersey. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess we'll start there in Canada with you, Robert. Your initial thoughts on the story, Rob.
This we're seeing again is all the response of the United States. The United States has been at war in Afghanistan for over 20 years, has caused all kinds of suffering there. The United States initially supported the Taliban and opposed the Taliban, and the people in Afghanistan have suffered horribly as a result. Now the U.S. has announced its withdrawal finally after 20 years, and the people of Afghanistan will be left to establish a government of their own. It's not going to be easy after 20 years of this war and interference from the United States, but it's what they must do. Whether or not the Taliban becomes victorious and rules the country remains to be seen. But the bottom line is that people are suffering horribly as a result of this 20-year onslaught, and the United States has responsibility for all of it.
That's a good point, Robert. Thank you for joining us. And Nicholas Ayala, I'd like to welcome you to the program now. Nicholas, you know, to Robert's point, and it's a great point, that, you know, regardless how you look at it, right now, okay, there's going to be instability for a while, but initially, ultimately, inevitably, you have to give this country back to the Afghan people. The U.S. and NATO cannot stay there forever. It's a, you know, arguably they stayed there way longer than they're supposed to stay, and possibly they should have never gone in there in the first place. Your thoughts on Afghanistan as we see it and the challenges it has today?
Well, I mean, I agree wholeheartedly with Robert that the only people who know what's best for their nation, for their sovereignty, is the people who actually make up that nation, who actually live in those community. The U.S. went into Afghanistan with the hopes of defeating terrorism, and what the result has been is 250,000 Afghanis dead, massacres not only by the United States, like we saw in 2017 with the Staff Sergeant Robert Bales killing over a dozen Afghanis, including some children, but also what we've seen recently pop up with the Australian soldiers who went in there massacring civilians. What's been the result of this NATO-led alliance of this imperialist aggression led by the United States with the cooperation of NATO has been only more terror for the Afghani people, but not at the hands of groups like the Taliban, but at the hands of Western-led imperialist powers who have terrorized the people, who have massacred civilians, and who have brought more instability, which has benefited their populations, their corporations, right, their elite, who have been able to profit off of this war and make, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars through the military-industrial complex, through all kinds of corporations trying to rebuild Afghanistan, only after it was destroyed by the U.S. imperialists. And that's been the result of this two-decades-long war. The only people who can fix this situation is the Afghani people and those who are allied with them to actually promote their sovereignty and their national determination.
Thanks. And Robert, can you make the argument that Afghanistan is much more worse off now because of opium cultivation as at an all-time high? The Taliban, I mean, perhaps before they might have had, power over a lot more than they possibly have at this exact point and juncture in time. But at the same time, they were against 20 years ago, the opium trade, opium cultivation. And in this last 20 years, they learned to utilize it because they had to for to get arms. So they've gotten into the business. They've made the business flourish. They use it to arm themselves and fight back against NATO and the U.S., and not to mention against the Kabul government. But basically, you've made the Taliban stronger than ever. You've pumped up the opium supply there to its peak of more than it's been ever. What have you done for the Afghan people now that you're leaving?
The U.S. government and NATO and the other participants in this awful war have done nothing but make life much worse for the people. As you mentioned, the opium trade is flourishing, and that is causing untold suffering not only in Afghanistan but in other parts of the world as well. The things we don't talk about very much, the rate of air pollution in Afghanistan is so astounding. There's fecal matter in the air. There is people are not safe in their homes, not safe anywhere. There has been no benefit to 20 years of war, except, as your other commentator mentioned, to the people who benefit from the military-industrial complex. Some people have made millions upon millions of dollars by this war, and that's all they care about. That's all the United States cares about. The United States government was never concerned about the autonomy of the Palestinian people, their right to self-determination, It just wanted to have a show of force and maintain a war somewhere so that the military contractors in the United States could gain astronomical profits through sales of their weaponry. This is something that has been going on for decades and decades, and Afghanistan is just the most recent and most tragic and longest example of this. But as far as any benefit to the people of Afghanistan, they have received none. Things have gotten much, much worse for them because of U.S. interference.
Gentlemen, always a pleasure to have you both on. Stay safe, both of you, and thank you. Robert Fantina, author and journalist here, joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. Mr. Nicholas Ayala, editor at Anti-Conquista, joining us from New York, Newark, New Jersey. And thanks for tuning in to the News Review program, and bye-bye for now.
Welcome back. Pakistani women have staged a protest in Karachi after Prime Minister Imran Khan blamed female rape victims for dressing inappropriately. Organizers called the Prime Minister's statement totally unacceptable and asked him to apologize or resign. Imran Khan had said that, quote, if a woman is wearing very few clothes, it will have an impact on the men unless they are robots. Victims of sexual abuse are often viewed with suspicion, and criminal complaints in this regard are rarely seriously investigated in Pakistan. The country regularly ranks among the worst places on the planet in terms of gender gender equality. Now, thousands of members of Iraq's popular mobilization forces have held a military parade attended by Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi. The event was held at Camp Ashraf in the eastern province of Diyala. The military base was formerly occupied by U.S. forces. The parade marked the 7th anniversary of the formation of the PMF. Weaponry, including tanks and rocket launchers, were put on display in the biggest demonstration of the PMF's military might. In an address, Kadhimi paid tribute to the sacrifices of the forces in fighting Daesh terrorists. The PMF was established after a 2014 call to arms by Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, to help defeat Daesh. Elsewhere, thousands of people rally in London in the latest round of protests against coronavirus lockdown measures, demanding an immediate end to the restrictions. Police arrested 12 people and confiscated items ahead of the demonstration, which also protested against several other social issues. Meanwhile, UK's Health Secretary Matt Hancock resigned following revelations that he violated coronavirus restrictions. Latest developments come as COVID-19 cases surge rapidly in the country in the light of the emergence of the Delta variant. The UK has recorded over 18,000 new coronavirus infections, the highest daily rise since February the 5th. It has also registered 23 deaths. The latest figures have pushed the country's total confirmed cases to nearly 4.7 million, with 128,000 fatalities. The coronavirus pandemic continues to spread fast around the world, with the global COVID-19 cases surpassing 180 million. The total number of fatalities from the respiratory disease is also nearing 4 million. Tunisia has recorded over 4,600 cases, its highest daily tally since the pandemic began. Thailand has announced new restrictions in and around the capital, Bangkok, to stem the spread of the contagion. Meanwhile, Brazil's health ministry reported over 64,000 new daily cases with nearly 1,600 deaths. Brazil has witnessed the world's third worst outbreak and the second highest death toll following the U.S. A hot air balloon has crashed in the U.S. city of Albuquerque, New Mexico, leaving all its five passengers dead. Four individuals died at the scene of the incident, while another one was pronounced dead later on in the hospital. No one on the ground was hurt. According to police, the craft crashed into a power line, causing the balloon to separate from the basket. The ensuing power cut has affected some 13,000 homes and businesses in the city for several hours. Officials have launched an investigation into the incident. Now, the death toll and the partial collapse of a high-rise apartment building in the U.S. state of Florida has risen to five.
Three bodies uncovered means that we now have accounted for 130, and it means that the unaccounted is now gone down to 156. Confirmed deaths are now at a total of five.
The Miami-Dade County mayor noted that the search and rescue operation is still underway. Meanwhile, U.S. media have revealed a report by a consultant engineer that warned of evidence of major structural damage to the concrete slab below the building's pool deck. The 2018 report had also noted abundant cracking and crumbling in the underground parking garage. According to U.S. media, the report, however, did not indicate that the building was at risk of collapse. A large portion of the 12-story residential building in Miami crumbled on Thursday while residents were asleep.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight. A laborer discovered a fossil and hid it in a well for 85 years in Harbin in northern China's province of Heilongjiang during the Japanese occupation. Scientists say it could help sort out the human family tree and how our species emerged. We now present you an article written by The Guardian science editor Ian Sample. The piece is titled Massive Human Head in Chinese Well Forces Scientists to Rethink Evolution. The discovery of a huge fossilized skull that was wrapped up and hidden in a Chinese well nearly 90 years ago has forced scientists to rewrite the story of human evolution. Analysis of the remains has revealed a new branch of the human family tree that points to a previously unknown sister group, more closely related to modern humans than the Neanderthals. The extraordinary fossil has been named a new human species, Homo longi, or Dragon Man by Chinese researchers, although other experts are more cautious about the designation. Professor Chris Stringer, research leader at the Natural History Museum in London, who worked on the project, said, "I think this is one of the most important finds of the past 50 years," adding, "It's a wonderfully preserved fossil." The skull appears to have a remarkable backstory. According to researchers, it was originally found in 1933 by Chinese laborers building a bridge over the Songhua River in Harbin, in China's northernmost province of Heilongjiang, during the Japanese occupation. To keep the skull from falling into Japanese hands, it was wrapped and hidden in an abandoned well, resurfacing only in 2018 after the man who hid it told his grandson about it shortly before he died. An international team led by Professor Qiang Ji at the Hebei Geo University in China drew on geochemical techniques to narrow down when the skull came to rest in Harbin, dating the bones to at least 146,000 years ago. The skull has a unique combination of primitive and more modern features, with the face in particular most closely resembling Homo sapiens. One huge molar remains. Which is 23 centimeters long and more than 15 centimeters wide, is substantially larger than a modern human skull and has ample room at 1,420 milliliters for a modern human brain. Beneath the thick brow ridge, the face has large square eye sockets, but is delicate despite its size. Professor Stringer said, "This guy had a huge head." The researchers believe the skull belonged to a male about 50 years old who would have been an impressive physical specimen. His wide bulbous nose allowed him to breathe huge volumes of air, indicating high-energy lifestyle, while sheer size would have helped him withstand the brutally cold winters in the region. Professor Xi Junyi, a paleoanthropologist at Hebei Geo University, said, "Homo longi is heavily built, very robust," adding, "It is hard to estimate the height, but the massive head should match a height higher than the average modern human." To work out where the Harbin individual fitted into human history, the scientists fed measurements from the fossil and 95 other skulls into software that compiled the most likely family tree. To their surprise, the Harbin skull and a handful of others from China formed a new branch closer to modern humans than Neanderthals. The Chinese researchers believe the Harbin skull is distinct enough to make it a new species, but Professor Stringer is not convinced. He believes it is similar to another skull found in Dali County in China in 1978. He said, "I prefer to call it Homo daliensis, but it's not a big deal." Professor Stringer added, "The important thing is a third lineage of later humans that are separate from Neanderthals and separate from Homo sapiens." Details are published in three papers in The Innovation. Whatever the name, one possibility is that the Harbin skull is Denisovan, a mysterious group of extinct humans known largely from DNA and bone fragments recovered from Siberia. Professor Stringer said, certainly this specimen could be Denisovan, but we have to be cautious. What we need is much more complete skeletal material of the Denisovans alongside DNA evidence. Professor John Hawkes, a paleoanthropologist at University of Wisconsin at Madison, said the idea of a new lineage of humans was a provocative claim because skulls can look similar even among distant relatives. He added the skull being Denisovan was a good hypothesis, though he was less keen on a new species name. He said, I think it's a bad moment in science to be naming new species among these large-brained humans that all interbred with each other. He added, what we are repeatedly finding is that the differences in looks didn't mean much to these ancient people when it comes to breathing. Mark Maslin, a professor of Earth System Science at University College London and the author of The Cradle of Humanity, said, the beautifully preserved Chinese Harbin archaic human skull adds even more evidence that human evolution was not a simple evolutionary tree, but rather a dense, intertwined bush. We now know that there were as many as 10 different species of hominins at the same time as our own species emerged. Mark Maslin, a professor of Earth System Science at University College London, added, genetic analysis shows that these species interacted and interbred. Our own genetics certainly contained a legacy of many of these ghost species. But what is a sobering thought is that despite all this diversity, a new version of Homo sapiens emerged from Africa about 60,000 years ago, which clearly outcompeted, outbred, and even outfought these other closely related species, causing their extinction. It is only by painstaking research and analysis of their fossils, such as the Harbin skull, do we know of their existence.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and to begin the day, we present you a bezel of wisdom from the Holy Prophet's eighth infallible heir, Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Rizal, peace be upon him, on respect due to parents. God punishes people for two sins in this world, injustice and ungratefulness towards parents.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shuma dar in qarn mojiza kardid. ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است.
الله اکبر خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر خمینی رهبر.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. In the name of Allah, the exalted, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our program, The Man Who Changed the World. Of course, this program is dedicated to the memory of Imam Khomeini. May God bless his great soul. And it's about his life and times and his great personality. I'm your host for this program, Ijaz Hussain, and I'd first like to welcome my guest who on the program who is going to discuss this great personality with me, and that's Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, my good friend, and I'd like to say salam to him and welcome him to the program.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. He's an Islamic scholar as well as an academic and a researcher as well. I think we're going to begin from, you know, our continuation, because this is like part two of what we were saying in our previous program, which was about the Bakhtiar government and about the fact that Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, was like a lion, right? In
yes.
terms of, you know, you talked about the threat offer that was given by the American government at the time.
Threat and offer.
Threat and offer. And, you know, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, comes out with the fatwa for a jihad against the U.S., which was something that, you know, they hadn't come across. They were completely...
No, it was, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, basically, and this goes back to, you know, we mentioned in the previous program that Supreme Leader recently was talking about Imam.
Sure.
And we had the quote. I don't know if you want, maybe we can...
Yeah, let's have that quote again. You know, if we could have that quote, please, from the Supreme Leader, and then we'll carry on with our discussion.
کسی مثل امام بزرگوار ما که یک تنه وارد شد.
Somebody like our magnanimous Imam, who single-handedly entered the arena, managed to unite all the people and launch this great movement with his firm determination, faith, and reliance on God, relied more than anything else on knowledge and understanding, on worship of God, and on the enthusiasm which originates from one's heart and soul. Until the end of his life, this great person used to wake up in the middle of the night and shed tears despite being old and physically weak.
با وجود پیری و ناتوانی و شکستگی نیمه شب برمیخواست اشک میریخت. ما خبر داشتیم از نزدیکان ایشان که به
We knew it because we had heard from his close relatives, who knew everything about his lifestyle, that he used to wake up in the middle of the night and ask Allah, the Exalted, for help. He used to keep a vigil at night. He was like this at night, and during the day, he used to enter the arena like a roaring lion and defeat global powers and solve the people's problems. He used to strengthen and set in motion the determination of all the people, thanks to his reliance on spirituality.
Yes,
I mean, as I say, it's a very, very powerful speech there by the Supreme Leader about Imam Khomeini.
But carry on with your
right.
your point
so
from the
we
last
we
yeah.
talked about the fact
yeah.
that, you know, at the time you basically had the Shah left.
That's right.
And he had appointed a government
mm-hmm.
led by Shapur Bakhtiar as the government. Sure. Imam from the beginning
mm.
refused
right.
to acknowledge the
That's
legality
right.
of this government,
sure.
which, you know, we're talking about the fact that
mm.
Imam was a person who combined spirituality, but also was very courageous and also led people.
Yes.
And this being something very new, or he revived this
revived it.
This
yeah.
this divine tradition,
sure.
this prophetic tradition.
Prophetic tradition.
Which had been lost, you know, with the
Over
separation.
The centuries,
right.
yes, unfortunately. Yes.
And having to do with the weaknesses of Christianity itself.
Yes.
This is why it was abandoned in Western civilization, because Christianity itself was, you know, changed in such a way that it no longer
became relevant.
Exactly.
Mm.
So at that time, they said to Imam, I'm just quickly repeating what we spoke
Please.
About in the previous program, and
Please.
Then continuing
sure.
the as, you know, an analysis of this.
Mm-hmm.
They said to Imam at that time, well, you got what you wanted. The Shah has left, you know.
Yeah.
Just, you know, it's done.
That's right.
Good job.
And good job. Go
Thank
back
you.
To the mosque.
Okay.
Now.
Right. And so basically, they sent a message to him through one of these people that was connected to both sides, saying
right. yeah.
saying that, you know, if you don't accept the Bakhtiar government,
mm.
we will tell the Americans.
The
sent this
yes,
message to Imam.
Yes, it's the offer. Yes.
That if you don't accept the Bakhtiar government, we will tell the army, which at that time the Americans had influence on, because a lot of the officers were American trained.
Sure.
We will tell the army to conduct a coup d'etat and arrest all of you and execute all of you. So what would be the usual response? Because remember, we quoted Henry Kissinger saying that Imam would make decisions that were, you know, earth-shaking. We didn't know how to deal with it.
Didn't know how to deal with
it. We didn't know what to do. He would do things that were completely different than everybody else.
Absolutely.
And again, Henry Kissinger saying that, you know, this was because his view was based on divine teachings, on divine teachings and precepts, and thus we didn't know what to do with all this. And, you know, you talked about the fact that, you know, other administration members at that time, U.S. administration, said that, you know, when in the meetings of
yes,
the experts,
yes, Secretary of State George Shultz
would
yes.
come up with, you know, what should we do about Ayatollah Khomeini, and everybody would just look at each other, you know, we don't know what
yeah,
to do.
Yeah, well, Shultz being of a German descent anyway, you know, and that's saying something.
Well, Henry is German.
Well, he is German.
Right, exactly.
Sorry.
Right. So
I stand corrected.
Right.
Yeah.
So the point is that Imam, in response
mm.
to this threat by the Americans,
mm.
says, if you do this,
mm.
I will. He didn't issue the fatwa of
no.
jihad. He said, I will issue a fatwa of jihad, and we will fight and take over the country ourselves. So, you know, remember, this is
yeah.
in the context where the Americans... where Mr. Kissinger himself
mm.
recently had overthrown Allende in Chile. And
yes,
yeah, you
yes.
know,
oh, yes.
What's the guy's name? Pinochet.
Pinochet
had come
in Chile.
And killed all the opposition.
Yeah, sure.
You had the same thing happening, Suharto, in Indonesia, killing 500,000
yes.
Communist Party members,
yes.
you know, in,
yes.
in Indonesia, or, you know, people related to it.
Sure.
You had this happening around the world by the Americans. What I mean with this happening is... the military connected to the U.S.
Mm.
conducting coup d'etats and killing
mm.
the opposition
Absolutely.
To the Americans in the country.
Sure.
Okay, so this was not some empty
yeah,
threat.
There was not an empty threat.
This
no.
was not something, you know, people had seen this.
Well, I mean, I was going to also say that, you know, we're talking about the aftermath of even the Vietnam War, because even the Vietnam War was fairly recent up until the time of the
right.
Islamic Revolution. So let's not forget... there was a hell of a lot of war crimes and barbarity shown in Vietnam. And with, you know, the B-52 bomber, with all that, you know, those famous photographs that we see in Apocalypse Now, you know, they show the bombs all coming down, raining bombs all over Vietnam. So you're right, you know, it's not on the back of an empty threat. This is real. I mean, this is something
and
that
a lesser
they, could
man
have, they could have devastated
and
Iran.
A lesser man would have folded.
Exactly. A lesser
so
man
is the,
would have
this
folded.
Is the, this is the point. Okay, this person
mm.
who is... was the connection, which
sure.
we mentioned in the previous program. He
yeah.
was a member of the religious national movement in Iran, who had lived in the States for many years, has spent his exile time in the States. He told the story on the BBC. We are quoting his story as he has explained
yes,
in the
absolutely.
So nobody
yeah.
thinks that we're making up stories.
No,
here,
we're not making
right?
up stuff. This is all archived.
Right. So he when he's telling this story on the BBC, you could tell he didn't understand. He was frustrated. He's like, why would Imam like tell them this? Why didn't he just accept it and go to home and, you know? And this is a religious person.
Yes.
Remember, this is not somebody, you know, who is, you know, whatever.
There are religious people in inverted commas and religious
right.
people.
So the point is, as you said, it's, you know, you having this deep belief. It's
deep
not only
belief.
About reading the Quran. It's not only about,
no.
you know, it's about
because you
belief.
Mentioned this word faith, didn't you? You
right.
mentioned
it's faith.
This
it's
it.
Not just knowing things.
Knowing
you, have things. To you have to believe in it.
Yeah,
when the Quran says that you can stand up to the biggest oppressors and be successful,
sure.
well you have to believe it.
You have
it's,
to believe
you know,
it.
It's good to read it. It's good to say, well, you know, give it, you're doing a speech, you're doing a radio program, blah, 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 you know, yeah. And the Quran says, and but you don't really believe it in your life, you know, if you don't translate that in your life. You know, what's the point? So this is the beauty of Imam, is that
Mashallah,
he had complete trust in Allah, had complete trust in the word of Allah.
Yeah, we could see that.
And he lived it. And when he was challenged and when he was tested by Allah and when Shaitan tried to, you know, threaten him with, what is it, with poverty and corruption.
Kinds of things, corruption
right? He
was, yeah.
stood up and he, you know, said, this is the deal.
Yeah.
So he... This is the first part. As
the first part, that's right. That's
so then he comes to Iran. Bakhtiar government is still there.
Still there.
He
yes,
enters the famous film of him coming with
the
plane.
Cemetery, yes.
And he goes directly from the airport. Yeah. He goes to Besht Sahara, which
throughout
is the
adulation of you know millions welcoming him at Mehrabad.
Right.
Airport,
and
yeah.
throughout the way on
way,
the road, as we've
way.
Seen in the films.
Sure.
He goes straight to Besht Sahara, which is the main cemetery
yeah,
in Tehran.
Big iconic images. Yes.
Right. And he goes to the area where many of the shuhada of the revolution
that's
and
right,
the fight
martyrs,
against
yes, at Behesht Yazara, yes.
Against the regime of the Shah are
right.
buried, and he holds a speech there.
That's correct, yes.
And here, remember, this is with the threat that he's gotten.
Yes, already.
Okay, there's rumors, and everybody's scared that, you know, they're going to shoot down his plane. Mm. And they say to him, well, what if... he goes, takes a nap during the flight.
Yes, he does.
You know, they're like, everybody's like on tenderhooks.
Yeah, yeah,
like
they're all sort of like...
you know,
yeah,
we're going to get shut down.
A SAM battery opening
right,
up any moment.
Right,
yeah.
And he goes and takes a nap, okay, because
yes.
he's... He gets off the plane, you know, you have this in this typical Eastern, you know, emotionalism saying, oh, what do you feel?
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
right,
about entering. He goes,
John Simpson asked him that.
You
yes.
know, he goes, nothing. No, no, it was an Iranian.
Was it an Iranian?
He says, what do you feel? And he says the famous Heech, which
Heech,
is
yes.
nothing.
Nothing.
What do you feel? Nothing.
That's right.
And they misunderstood. Right. When he meant Heech, it meant that, you know, this people coming and, you know, this is not the issue.
This is not the issue. This is not
this
the
is
point.
Not the
that's
issue. The fact
that's the
that,
most important
you know,
point,
it's not
yeah.
that I don't feel anything.
No,
it's the fact that this is not the point.
Point.
That, you know, I'm coming or there's going to
no,
be, you know.
No.
The point is, you know, the people and having justice and establishing
yes,
justice.
That's right.
So he goes to the, he goes to Beit Zahra.
Yes.
He has that famous speech, which, you know, just thinking about it, I'm just, you know, you just get
yeah,
emotional
yeah.
because
oh,
you the speech starts with the children. There's a children's choir and they're singing this very famous song, which
yes.
is in Iran is famous, talking about the martyrs and, well, anyways, I mean, this was a, it's a very moving and emotional thing, and then he starts talking, and he says, you know, this is, you remember, 80-year-old Grand Ayatollah?
Exactly.
He says, we will punch this government in the mouth.
That's right.
We will establish our own government.
من دولت تعیین میکنم. من تو دهن این دولت میزنم.
من دولت تعیین میکنم. من به پشتیبانی این ملت دولت تعیین میکنم. من به واسطه این که ملت مرا قبول دارد.
So, remember, all of this in the context of coup d'etat, you know, killing, executions, this is all
that's
being
right.
threatened.
That's right.
So he goes and he stays in Qom at first. And what does the Bakhtiar government do? They issue martial law. They proclaim
do.
Martial law.
That's true.
Which is what all
yes, of course.
Oppressors do,
do
at some point.
At some point, yes.
Which is that people are not allowed to be in the streets after 4 o'clock in the afternoon. This was the martial law, and anybody there without permission with
will be shot.
Will be shot.
Yes,
remember, will be shot.
Shot. Yes. And this comes in the background, of course.
And people lost lives because of this. They had
yeah.
to go to the hospital. They couldn't go to the hospital.
Exactly.
People, you know, needing medication.
Sure.
So this is it's real.
Because
it's not
I wanted to put it in the context.
This because during the time of the Shah, the Shah
yeah,
would do this.
Yeah, that's right. This is what I wanted to mention.
Would, you know,
in 1963, for example.
Right.
Yeah,
so this
yeah.
was not something, you know, we, you know, people knew what this
people
meant.
People knew what this meant. Okay. This is serious.
Serious stuff. Mm. So what does Imam do? They say to him, well, it's martial law. What does Imam do? What does Imam say? Mm-hmm. Again, roaring lion.
Roaring lion.
Courage.
Back to that. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
He says, tell the people to go out.
Out. And knowing full well what the consequences
well,
are.
People around him. I'm talking about people around him.
Yeah.
Not
yeah.
even, you know,
yeah.
religious people, you know, revolutionaries.
Yeah.
They folded. They said, well, what if the people get killed?
Killed.
Mm. You know, the blood will be on your hands.
Hands.
This, you know, these kind of,
yeah, yeah.
you know,
yeah, sure.
threats and these kind
yeah,
of,
yeah,
you know,
of
underhanded.
Yeah.
As though Imam doesn't know.
Doesn't know.
So Imam's very calmly just says, tell the people to go out.
Oh.
And they went out, and that's it. That's when the revolution was successful.
Successful, yes.
Because the enemies, internally and externally, saw that there's nothing they can do.
Good.
No threat is going to scare this man. Okay?
Excellent.
And it's at that time when you see that within a couple of weeks, within a short period of time, the Bakhtiar government falls.
Falls, yes.
Okay?
Yeah.
And they talked about it in their interviews later on. I'm talking about the members of that
yeah.
of that government. We had a list of 500. We are already, you know, I'm talking about the Bakhtiar government,
yes,
not the military, which was supposed to do the coup d'etat and arrest everyone.
Right, right.
The Bakhtiar government itself, the people in that government, again, on the BBC, so people don't think we're making up stories
no,
here,
no.
came on and said we had a list of 500 or 600 people.
Yes.
We already had the prison.
I saw the same program.
We had the prison ready in some far off place. We were going to go and arrest everybody in one night
sure.
and take them to that camp and
mm-hmm.
decide what we're going to do with mm-hmm. them, and you know, and we had the list of executions and so on and so forth. So
they did.
So again, this shows the man, because we're talking about his extraordinary personality.
Well, of course we are.
His reliance on God. None of this could have happened for Imam. Imam could not have had that strength and that courage if he didn't believe in God.
God, of course.
If he didn't trust God completely.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? If he did not have complete faith and belief in the promises of God as is stated in the Quran.
Sure.
If he did not have complete trust and did not take as his model the model of the Prophet, peace be upon him.
Of course.
Of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Peace be upon him. Yes.
Okay? So, this is what we're trying to say here, which is that you have this man, the way that the Supreme Leader explains it, who was the same level that he was courageous and able to come out. He also spent the nights, you know, pleading and seeking
yes.
grace
from
and
God. Yes.
from God.
Yes.
He derived his strength from that personal worship and that personal servitude to God,
of course.
Which then translated into his power
of course.
Against the enemies.
Right.
This is an important lesson for Muslims.
It is, very
okay?
much so.
Your power
so.
Doesn't come from anything but God.
God.
And how do you tap that? You tap that by being a servant of God. Okay?
Right.
We say it, it's easy to say.
It's easy to say.
But it's difficult to implement. You know, we all are. So don't, you know,
yeah,
when we
I
say
know.
These things,
I know.
We're
I
not
know.
Talking as though we've done this,
no.
you know, very well
no.
in our
My
own
God.
Lives.
No,
but we at least.
I wouldn't even want to venture there.
But at least we saw somebody who did.
Who did.
And there was Imam.
Mm.
And he will always be an example. And he will also be Hujjat. He will be
Hujjat, yes.
for us in the next world,
in
the sense that I'm talking could be against us. Allah will say to us, look, I sent somebody, he was your example. You
That's
could have
right.
followed.
Because the Holy Quran says that there is no time, no period that the world will not be without an Imam, right? So
right.
even though we are still waiting for the, you know, the last Savior to reappear, but you know, this is no less
on a lesser degree
yeah.
we can say that somebody who lived in this time
yes
Allah can say to them, look
yeah.
here was a man,
here was
he lived Islam he was completely it's interesting Shahid Muhammad Baghir Sadr,
please,
the
yes.
famous martyr in from Najaf Hawza, Iraqi
yes
you know
yes
who was one of the I mean he's also one of those incredible
great, yeah, great
human
scholars.
Beings that just come along every couple centuries
yes.
He said, you know, immerse yourself into Imam and his teachings the way Imam immersed himself into Islam. Okay? This is his famous saying.
Where is it? Where
okay?
Is it?
So Imam was immersed in Islam.
Immersed.
And who says this? Shahid Asad says this.
Says.
Okay?
Yes.
And he's saying, Shahid Assad is saying to his students and to the young people at that time and to the followers and to the, he's saying, you know, look at the way Imam immersed himself in Islam. You immerse yourself in this life, in this teachings, in this example of the Imam, of Imam. And it's interesting, Shahid Assad, who, according to, you know, everybody who was there in Najaf at that time, basically was a mujtahid from before he reached the age of taklif. So,
right.
You know, this is very rare.
Very rare.
It's very rare that somebody so young.
He was a genius.
He was a genius. Okay. He was certified genius.
He was.
Okay. So they asked him, by the time he was 15, 16, he was mujtahid, meaning he was a full ayatollah in terms of being able to issue fatwas.
Right.
Very difficult. And a person like him has this to say about Imam. He says, if Imam ordered me to become a judge in some far-off village in Iran, I would do so in a heartbeat. Okay? This is a man who is a full, you know, full scholar in all branches of Islamic teachings, philosophy, fiqh, usul, you know, history, a complete scholar at a young age, a genius.
No doubt.
Because, you know, we've had that in our history. People like Ibn Sina, people
Allama
Hilli.
I mean,
you know, we've had people
His works were even acknowledged in Paris, you know, because they even foresaw the end of
capitalism.
So
anybody who's familiar with Shahid Muhammad Baghir Assad knows what we're talking about. And here's a man who says, if Imam ordered me, after this is after the revolution, and this is one of the reasons, this is the main reason they killed him. Saddam killed him, because he did not renounce and denounce Imam and the revolution.
That's right.
Which was a major threat to Saddam. And then, of course, Saddam attacked. So, and so you have somebody like Shahid Assad who with this heavy scholarly weight, with this amazing, you know, talent and abilities, a real leader, he's saying to us, if Imam ordered me to become a judge in a small village or a small area in Iran, I would do it in a heartbeat. Okay, this is the level of person we're talking about. We have Maraje, we have Ayatollah Uzmas, we have, and these—they are all, you know, we kiss their hand, and they are the ones that we follow when we're talking. And then you have somebody like Imam, who's just on a totally different level. He's Marja, he's Alim, he's Faqih, he's Arif, and then he's a leader. He's a leader of humanity. He's a leader of people, of societies, of the Ummah. Not only does he teach it and discuss it on a scholarly level, he implements it.
He lives it.
Okay? This is the difference. This is why we are, this is what we're so lacking in the world of Islam.
We are.
We sit around, even the good ones, we sit around, we talk a lot, we have it all figured out theoretically, but nobody takes action. It's about action. Islam is about what you do.
Do.
Okay? You can have all the laws memorized, you can have the entire Quran memorized, you can know the history of the Prophet, peace be upon him,
backwards.
If you don't act on it, if you don't implement it in your life, it doesn't. There's no point
to it all,
right?
Yes.
This is the, as they say, muqaddama. It's the introduction to you acting on it.
Mm-hmm.
When a man like Imam is threatened by the most powerful
government
forces in the earth, he doesn't fold. This is what the Prophet did.
Yes,
the Prophet was being threatened by everyone around him, Quraysh. They tried to buy him off.
They threatened him.
They killed the people around him.
Yeah.
You know, they banished him.
That's right.
They boycotted him. They imposed economic sanctions.
Sanctions on him. Yes, that sounds very similar.
You know,
very familiar.
The babies were dying in Shebe Abu Talib. The two years that they were living in the desert.
That's
before they went to Medina.
Yes,
the kids were dying because of a lack of medication. Gee, sounds familiar, right?
Yes,
and so he stood firm. The Prophet, peace be upon him. You had similar things happening to the Imams, Imam Ali alayhi salam being the prime example of this. You have, of course, the issues that are surrounded Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein alayhi salam in the time of, you know, Muawiyah and Yazid. And so, you know, these are the ones we follow, and this is who Imam followed. The example of our leaders, of our religious leaders. Of our divine leaders.
Divine leaders, yes.
The Prophet and the Imams. Imam Khomeini lived it.
Yes.
He showed to us that it's possible to do this and to be successful and to die as a man who has complete calmness in his heart and who has maintained his dignity throughout his life.
Yes.
There's a famous story they talk about, and you have to imagine Iran at that time, at the time of the Shah, which is, you know, it's the king, right? Mm. Wherever he goes, you stand up, you bow, you kiss his hand.
Yeah.
You know, as we still have today in some countries.
Yes, we do. Yes.
You know, you have to do the
very familiar part.
You have to do the little curtsy, and you have to do the little whatever.
Especially if you're going to receive a knighthood. You know,
right. So you know, these things are imperial traditions.
Yes, of course. They are.
And you know, not very Islamic.
No.
Just you know, putting it out there for discussion.
Sure.
So, there's a famous story about the Shah saying, "I want to visit the ulama in Qom." This is maybe you know, 15, 20 years before the. Maybe a little bit more, before the revolution.
Okay.
And in an imperial society, in a royal society, this is like the big deal. The Shah is coming to visit. Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. You know, this is it. All right? So the Shah enters the room. All the ulama get up, and Imam doesn't get up. You have to imagine. This is at the peak of the Shah's power.
Yes.
He is the king. You know, you have to throw yourself at his feet.
Yes, we're talking about Savak, one of the most ruthless...
Exactly.
Yeah, secret police that was operating here in this country.
You know, people being thrown out of helicopters
and disappearing
in the salt.
Not far here from Qom.
Right,
you know,
disappearing
the
in the salt
here.
Lakes of you know, around Qom, whatever.
Qom, yeah.
So, you know, here's a man.
Yeah.
He comes to visit, and his visit is not, you know, he
yeah.
says, I want, out of respect. Well, it's not out of respect.
Out of respect.
It's a threat.
Yeah.
It's saying,
threat.
Listen, I know you guys. I'm here. You better acknowledge me.
Mm.
You better kiss the hand.
Mm.
Right?
Mm.
So he's coming there, everybody gets up, Imam doesn't get up. That's it. You know,
yeah.
the example we brought was at the time of the revolution, even before the revolution. You know, this is at the
he's
height
an extraordinary man.
At the height of the power
courage.
Of the king, he stands, you know, and they're in the same room.
Mm.
It's not like some
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
theoretical opposition.
Yeah.
He's saying to the king, look, I don't have to stand for you.
Yeah. And who are you anyway?
Right, who are you anyway? So to, you know, summarize all this.
Yes, please.
We have a man and an example which is unique. It's truly unique.
I think so, yeah.
We had the privilege and Allah blessed us to be able to
see a
person like that.
Yes, and live in his time.
Right. And thus, after that, everything changed for us.
It did.
We can no longer be the way we were before.
That's true.
Okay?
That's true.
This is
true.
The point.
Yeah.
This is the point of what Supreme Leader is talking about when he talks about that he's on the level or very close to the level of the prophets and the awliya,
yes.
that he changed humanity, he
mm.
changed humans.
Mm.
It was more than just, you know, as big a deal as, you know, ending 2,500 years of, you know,
yeah.
monarchy.
It, because that's what we're seeing. This is not a narrow dynamic change just in the events of history. We are talking about something very, very fundamental.
It's a profound change.
Yes, it's a very profound change.
After, you know, the world before Imam is very different than the world
well,
after.
Well, after the Imam.
And especially
after.
In the Muslim world,
yes.
especially among Muslims. But even non-Muslims, you have many
yes.
cases and stories,
mm.
and, you know, you've seen them yourselves in your life.
Yeah, of course we are.
Where people who had nothing to do with Islam were completely, you know...
Mesmerized.
By Imam, and their lives changed after
mm.
that. You know, people... And we saw them,
yeah.
and we know them, and they are still living, and they can bear witness themselves
yes.
more than we can. But we
yes.
saw them,
yes.
that their life changed
yes.
because of what of Imam and the things he said and the things he did, and you know, I think a lot of what we see today in the world, whether it's related to Islamic awakening, and this is something the Supreme Leader has mentioned many times,
sure.
whether it's related to Islamic awakening, whether it's related to just this general idea of Muslims believing in Islam and wanting to have their own way of living and governing and lifestyle
mm.
as opposed to this imposed Western lifestyle.
Sure.
A lot of what we see even in so-called third world countries, in places like Asia or Africa or Latin America, this rebirth in terms of, you know, having your own institutions, becoming major players in the world and not simply becoming, you know, colonial subjects or, you know, appendages to the West. I think a lot of that, Imam contributed greatly to this thinking, even for non-Muslims. They saw Imam.
It really changed our frame
they,
of mind.
They saw Imam as a leader of a, you know, third world country, so-called, a leader of a liberation movement, a leader that stood up to imperialism, mainly American imperialism, and was able to, you know, establish a successful nation. And again, even if you